Hello, alumni of the Living School for Action and Contemplation. This is Mark Longhurst, the quarterly editor, class of 2015. I recently spoke with Living School Core faculty Cynthia Bourgeau to hear about what projects she's been working on lately, her mentor Bruno Barnhart, and an upsurge of interest in his work, her response to the quarterly theme of Nature, the First Bible, what wisdom means for her, and more. We even talk about the imaginal realm a little bit at the end. This interview is, no surprise, packed full of insights that only Cynthia can bring. I hope you enjoy. So thank you for taking some time, Cynthia, to talk to me and to the alumni community of the Living School. I want to start off and ask, what are you excited about right now? What are you working on lately?
Well, there's a few things that are going. One thing is that I've just had a book, accepted for publication on the imaginal realm, imaginal reality, and that'll be a new groundbreaker that nobody seems to know much about in the Christian context. So it will definitely be opening a new conversation pit. So that's not immediately on the plate because it's going to be 2020 before anybody sees the light of day with that one. But probably over the next year or so, gradually we'll be ramping up the teaching and the trailers on what is imaginal reality and why is it useful to Christians in general and to people in the Living School in particular.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of us that are, that we're all kind of deeply connected with Thomas Keating in the capacity of his interspiritual legacy. You know, mm-hmm. Many people know the work he did with centering prayer and contemplative outreach, and of course it's outstanding. But his other great love in life was interspiritual contemplative dialogue. We're bringing together in July in Colorado a group of people who have who were all formed by him and deeply influenced by him in this regard to honor his legacy and to listen deeply into what the next step forward is on this really important path for our world. So those are the things that are kind of taking the most of my time.
Well, I'm sure I speak for many in the alumni community that we're waiting for your book with bated hearts. And I've known from your Northeast Wisdom work that you have recently launched a Year of Bruno Barnhart, and some of us may know of his work. Who was Bruno Barnhart, and why did you choose him, and what do you think he has to offer us in our time and our moment today?
Bruno was a mentor of mine for more than 30 years. He was the abbot, the prior, as they label them at the monastery in Big Sur, California, New Camaldoli Hermitage, and a gifted writer and thinker and spiritual teacher. And our paths crossed back, I can hardly even remember when. I can't remember a time when I didn't know Bruno. So anyway, these were, when he died in 2015, many of us in the Wisdom Network were quite excited about his book, The Future of Wisdom. Mm-hmm. Some of his three books, The Future of Wisdom, and The Commentary on John, and I'm blocking what the second one was called, but they're a wonderful, wonderful trilogy. Mm-hmm. That kind of combines Teilhard with the wonderful non-dual work that was going on in the East in the Bede Griffith community. Mm-hmm. He's a clear non-dual Western thinker, probably one of the best we have, but he wasn't widely known because he wasn't writing academic theology or popular theology or any kind of theology that gets supported by little groups that get around them and do football cheering. So we just kind of figured that it was time to put his work back out there. And one of my younger colleagues in the Wisdom School really ran with getting the Future of Wisdom back in publication after it had sort of drifted out of publication. And so to kind of put a muscle on that and to get some interest building around the book and to put a very good resource in the hands of our Wisdom resource and our network and return an author who's whose work needs to be known better in our Christian community. We just launched this, and it's been going very well. People are intrigued. There are a lot of treasures in our community that are not known, partly because that's the nature of the way the scholarship and the religious dissemination is brokered there. You know, as always, it's favored towards calling attention to the ones that have the biggest spin behind them, that can make the biggest splash. And so a lot of the really great teachers in all generations have always remained beneath the radar a bit. And it takes some work to dig them out. In our tradition, some of the finest are not widely known. And so it's really important to create networks where they're usually much more subtly nuanced work can begin to infiltrate into the larger mix.
You refer to your work as located in the wisdom stream of the Christian lineage, and you've said that Bruno Barnhart's The Future of Wisdom and his wisdom work is inspiring your own work, and you also host wisdom schools. So I know that many alumni have gone to the wisdom schools and followed your work for many years, but for folks who might not be familiar with your work on wisdom, how do you describe wisdom?
Well, wisdom, my little short description is it's not knowing more, but knowing deeper, knowing with more of you engaged. And it works on an ancient pedigree, the pedagogy that supports the transformation of consciousness. And it's basically to say that you can't know more with simply your mind. That deep knowing is, and it's not just bringing in that old cliche that we all like to live, it's not just your mind and your heart, because most of us misidentify the heart anyway, but it's a way of balanced knowing that involves, intellectual knowing, emotional feeling knowing, and sensation carried in the body. So it's a three-centered, balanced awareness that transforms consciousness and makes it possible to take in things in less, in other than that sort of rigidly linear way that characterizes all intellectual thinking. And, the wisdom tradition would say basically that non-duality is impossible until wisdom, a wisdom kind of not only attitude but physiology has really been established in a being. So it's that the wisdom branch is specifically interested in the transformation of consciousness. It's interested in in non-duality, not so much as a state of a theological attitude or even a psychological attitude, as a whole new operating system of perception, And I guess that's what you'd say about the tradition, as distinguished from the contemplative. There's a lot of people doing centering prayer practice and Christian meditation and devotional practices and lectio, but wisdom always asks, so what kinds of transformations of being are these leading you into? And how does that result in the creation of a person who pays attention in a different way and acts in the world with a slightly different sort of, energetic presence?
That's really powerful. And I love the embodied nature of it, too. It sort of passes right by the Platonic dualism into a more holistic way of knowing.
Exactly. And, of course, so a lot of us, as we go to the Living School Symposia and things like that, some of us from a wisdom perspective would say, the whole system, while it's very, very efficient for conveying information, is just not set up for the transmittal, because there's just too much talking, there's too much mental absorbing, there's too much dialogue, there's too much debate, that the real wisdom routines, the real wisdom modalities are actually formed most closely in things like Benedictine monasticism and the other monasticisms in which that balanced ora et labora prayer of life mm-hmm. is not only a path of devotion, but is a path of transformation.
Who might be a couple of key figures in the wisdom Christian stream?
Well, Jesus. If you start reading Jesus really carefully, particularly if you just dive into the Gospel of Thomas and those that have not been so heavily edited by the ecclesiastical cult, you see that Jesus was really on and about creating conscious human beings who were aware of their position in a relational field, which he called the kingdom of heaven, and were able to act out of it. And so we march from Jesus right on through to our own day. We've got Bruno Barnhart and Beatrice Bruto, some of my favorites along the way. Jacob Burma certainly came from a wisdom perspective. Most of the Quaker mystics are in there. Mm-hmm. The desert tradition was, I think, Christianity's first and the way most effective wisdom tradition. I mean, these guys were really about the transformation of being. Well, that's what they were doing out there in the desert.
Thanks for
a lot of the people we read in the Living School curriculum basically dance in and out of this, but often impressionistically because it isn't acknowledged theologically in our tradition. When we talk about wisdom, people think you're talking about some books in the Old Testament.
So as we speak, I don't know if you know this, but the CAC is hosting its conference inspired by Father Richard's book, The Universal Christ.
Yeah.
And I wanted to simply ask, how are you thinking about the universal or cosmic Christ these days?
Well, I basically let Richard do the thinking on that. I think that he's deeply engaged, and he's come up with a wonderful new way of spinning it that I think works really effectively, and certainly there's millions of people out there that agree already, to think of it as an inside dimension in everything. And it's a wonderful way of universalizing it without unparticularizing it. It's a wonderful, I would call it a holographic approach, which is extraordinary. And very practical in all sorts of ways that Richard is, that's his signature thing for being practical about really important theological truths.
One of the themes that's running through this alumni magazine is Nature, the First Bible, and that's taking inspiration from Richard's book, but it's also taking inspiration from early church fathers who talked about the book of nature as a source of revelation. And so I wanted to ask, how do you envision God's revelation through the natural world? And how might some of your heroes, Panikkar and Teilhard de Chardin, what might they have to say about that subject?
Well, Mark, if I were to be brutally honest, I would say the whole question is jury-rigged from the start. Because it starts from the idea, the good old Hebrew idea that God is separate from nature. And then once you say that God is separate from nature, then you can say, oh, yes, but you can read God in nature, and you can get into, you can do all the wonderful panentheistic manipulations on it. But I think that if you really look at things from a different playing field, 1905 completely eliminated, knocked down the intellectual credible basis of a separate God, with Einsteinian theory of relativity. We simply can no longer think in terms of, of a material world and a spiritual world. We have to think about a single continuum of energy, and we have to think that God does not reside apart from this, but is coextensive and comprehensive of the whole thing, residing not only in the things, but in the spaces between the things, and the possibilities, and the latencies. There is nothing that is not God. And nature is not a spot that God does not take up. And And the problem I've had with panentheism is it still is too weak a starting point. It's saying, oh yeah, God can inhabit nature but doesn't get stuck in it. But you see, that still is imagining an Old Testament God that served its place and time, but simply does not exist anymore in any of the credible models that come to us from physics, from mysticism. And I'm not trying to say that, in a way of saying, well, throw out God and bring in science. I'm saying that the whole idea of that separate God is a beautiful, beautiful idea of the dualizing mind that was tremendously important in its own time and in its own era, and carried human knowledge a huge step further. But I think that one of the things that's crippling Christianity today is that out of, maybe we're just too weary to hack the tree right down to the roots where it needs to be hacked down to, but we still pay lip service to concepts that have no viable reality in the spiritual world anymore. And it's trying to make that happen that is just exhausting theological schools and all sorts of things. So I would say, of course, if you start with the model of the relational field, of the holograph, of the boundless dimensions of reality and the infinite creativity and fecundity of everything, and somehow equate God with both the infinite potential and the excruciating particularity of the whole thing. But that you hold as your kind of final point that it's in the relationality that anything emerges into actuality. Then I think you have a much better model for understanding both God and nature. And of course, nature's, the book of God, of course. Uh-huh. Why has it taken so long for people to figure that out?
Wow. I want to ask a follow-up question about that. If you sort of break open the category of revelation in that way, how do the scriptures situate themselves in, if all of reality is God revealing God's self all the time?
Well, I would say that as in Heisenberg, what we bring our consciousness to and our love to and our attention to, we animate. And I'm not trying to be simply subjective here and saying the scripture would have no validity if it weren't for our engagement with it. But it's over and over and over again through the legacy of our tradition, people have seen that in this living dialogue between human beings and these texts, something of a new quality of truth freshly emerges again and again. So I would not, again want to accord to them exclusive status, separate status. They're another of the very, very rich and powerful and particular viaducts through which God's presence is celebrated in this world.
That's really helpful. One word that we learned in the Living School was cosmotheandric from Raymond Panikkar. And cosmotheandric sounds a little bit different than panentheism. Can you unpack that for the alumni?
You're exactly right on that, and you're way ahead of a lot of theologians in understanding they are different, even though denotatively they're basically describing the same thing, but connotatively they're light years apart. Panentheism is a modification. It's in dialogue or in reactivity with pantheism, or the old horror that God could be somehow trapped in nature. So it's already a term whose loyalty and whose conceptual framework is found in the good old separation and the transcendent non-material God of basically our Western, fame. Cosmotheandric talks more about the map that I was trying to talk about a few minutes ago, the holographic, interpenetrating worlds within worlds, mutually indwelling dimensions within dimensions, circling, giving and receiving dynamic universe. And says that God is coextensive with all that.
I want to ask another question that's inspired by your recent collection of writings, Love is the Answer, What is the Question? You've got the title essay that talks about Teilhard de Chardin's view of love as a unifying force amidst complexity that also honors diversity. So unity, complexity, diversity. And I think about this really stuck moment that we're in both in America and globally, a reckoning moment of sorts around issues of historic injustice and diversity and identity issues. And I wanted to ask you, what might Teilhard's view of love have to say to our moment?
Well, I think that if we could really dig into it, it would help us 100%. And we don't even have to go to Teilhard, you know, we can go right back to the Bible and St. Paul and his incredible image about there are many parts of one body. And the head cannot say to the, you know, the arm, I do not need you, or the, remember how that one goes? Mm-hmm. It's actually the Teilhardian theory of unification and diversity in a nutshell.
Wow, that's great.
Because it says that the differentiation is absolutely essential to maintain a flow of information and relationship across various levels of consciousness, across various levels of complexity, which is what consciousness is. So the more the flow across greater levels of diversity, the more differentiation within an overall unity, the more consciousness, the more manifest consciousness a system is capable of.
Mm-hmm.
So our big problem, you know, our natural survival instinct is to gang with your gang. And to hang out with only those that are like you, and to grow those that are like you at the expense of those that are unlike you. Well, they call that cancer in the medical professions. That it's only as we begin to learn that consciousness is an emergent property of the whole, that we begin to not only accept but actually embrace diversity. With a full understanding that diversity is diverse. And I think one of the mistakes that we've made in earlier generations of equal rights and equal opportunities is that we try to cancel out diversity in the name of opportunity. And you can't do that. I mean, I've even seen that in the women's movement. Women are not men. They're biologically, psychologically, organically, spiritually different creatures, and that the solution is not to remove a baseline, but to really show how that in a united environment, these very, very different gifts and complementary attitudes move together to create a whole that's greater than the sum of its parts.
In closing, a last question I wanted to ask about, and you've talked about it a little bit, but about your wisdom network and what's inspiring you lately about the community and the movement that has been built up around your teachings?
Well, it seems to me that as I've studied the history of wisdoms and wisdom schools and wisdom traditions, that wisdom has always been sort of a latent gene in the gene pool of humanity and of the planet, but the wisdom schools tend to come to the surface in times of either great political upheaval or global instability, or times of great quantum leaps forward of consciousness. And I think that in our own time, we're seeing both. We certainly know that there's instability in climate change and in the nations and the organizations and the institutions which have created stability for our planet, in some cases, for 2,500 years. So it's a perfect time for the emergence of wisdom. And also there's this deep thing that people have all gotten pieces of, that we need to make it to a new level of consciousness or we're going to destroy ourselves. And so these are prime opportunities for the emergence of wisdom, which by its very nature is uncooptable. You know, the nature of institutional transmission is it tends to build institutions which get doctrinally procedurally heavy. And there begins to be a party line and a company line, and wisdom by its very nature and self-understanding travels in much lighter and more flexible arrangements, which means that it can move more quickly. Wisdom is also interested in the energetic transmission of ideas and the energetic impact, of addressing a situation politically, not by a manifesto, for example, or a march, but by a concentrated ability to articulate a heart energy and place it in a location so that the nature of the situation changes. These are kinds of skills at the energetic level that have always been transmitted in the great wisdom schools. And I think we're seeing a reemergence of that. It's one of the reasons why I have, so insistently proclaimed to people that the Living School is, while we are politically and contemplatively involved, we're not a pluralistic level. We're not a mean green school that's taking sides and demonizing and judging, because in what we're beginning to learn at the Living School, there's the seeds of the beginning to be the artists of new becoming, using the tools of energy and presence and attention, rather than anger and zealotry and idealism and polarizing. So that's what's got me excited about.
Can you give an example of what change looks like on this imaginal wisdom level? Because we're so used to thinking about change as what I can affect through my effort. And you're talking about something else. Can you give an example of to make that concrete for us?
Well, how did Pope Francis get elected? Impossible. And the emergence of the Taizé community out of nowhere and that whole renaissance. These are just a few. I've documented a few of these in my book. But it very often will seem to come out of left field, where something that was not linearly possible given the configuration, all of a sudden the configuration shifts for no particular reason, and it's a whole new ballgame.
Wow. And I'm also hearing that in your wisdom work, it's holistically attuning the body, heart, mind to operate on that level.
Exactly.
Wow.
And I think there are so many changes and close saves in the history of the planet that we don't even see. Because the people who work in this kind of way, again, like to keep their heads below the radar. And, there is a post to be held, and it's a really important one, to stand up there and put the word out and get millions of people thinking in new ways. That's a really important piece of the forward-moving operation. But there's also, in some ways, the most hardcore and finest-pointed work is always done completely inconspicuously.
Wow.
That there's an old Yiddish saying that the world at any given point in time has been held on its orbit by 36 conscious human beings. Who are not even sure that they're one of the 36 and certainly don't know each other. But
wow.
The quality of their work rises like incense and connects with help that's also flowing to us from the other side. From the watchers and holy ones that are always protecting this planet, because it's important. This planet is precious and valued, irreplaceable in the overall dynamism of divine manifestation.
Wow. I find that profoundly hopeful. Thank you.
Yeah, it is hopeful. So to be a part of that, what you have to give up, in a way, is your egoic gratification. And I'm not saying that in a small sense or a mean-spirited one. I mean, the more you have enough being to work inconspicuously, the more likely, the more efficiently your work is going to connect it with the places where the work is being done.
It's bringing cause and effect to an entirely different field. Is that right?
Exactly. Wow. Exactly, because only in this world is cause and effect linear. In imaginal causality, it's spatial, and as I say in the book, chiastic. They're balanced wholes in a single larger picture, and so that's the part that as you begin to learn to completely reframe and restructure your being to become permeable to that way of seeing and being and acting. And in some sense coherent and consistent with it, a whole different cone of possibility opens up within a person for impact upon and within the world.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us and the alumni community. We really appreciate your time and your reflections, Cynthia.